Well, I think the one thing that we all know that's important to know and doesn't have to be set straight is that China is big. So many people in such a vast country. The other part that maybe is less obvious is how diverse China is, north and south, east and west, urban and rural. And although someone like a Sun Yat-sen or any national leader has to act as if China is one country and one people, I think any visitor or anyone who reads Chinese literature or looks at Chinese art is struck by the tremendous diversity of Chinese culture. And that diversity, of course, is the kind of problem that Sun Yat-sen tried to grapple with when he argued that leading China is like picking up a handful of sand. How can you forge this into something that can act more collectively?
Leading Chinese, next on Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Political scientist David Strand is here to talk about Chinese leadership in the early years of the 20th century. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, We Keep the Lights On, and more. The British Prime Minister Winston Churchill is said to have remarked about China, "It's an enigma wrapped in a puzzle surrounded by a mystery." But for one scholar who recently worked at the National Humanities Center, China is not so much mysterious as complex. David Strand teaches political science at Dickinson College. He's at work on a study of Chinese political leadership with special emphasis on President Sun Yat-sen between the years 1911 and 1925. By paying attention to Chinese social history in the early years of the 20th century, according to David Strand, we increase our chances of understanding what's going on in China today. David Strand is the author of a book about Beijing in the 1920s and co-editor of a forthcoming collection of essays entitled Reconstructing 20th Century China. Give our listeners, David, a quick sense of Sun Yat-sen, who he was, why he's important to you as a historian, and maybe some quick basic facts and figures about this man.
Contemporaries described him as China's George Washington in the sense that he's a founder of modern Chinese politics and the Chinese Republic. He was born in southern China in 1866 in a small village, and as a young man managed to go to Hawaii to join his brother, who was a merchant there, received a Christian education, returned to southern China, studied to be a doctor, and by the 1890s had become a revolutionary against the Qing dynasty. He spent 16 years in exile, finally returning to China in 1911 in time to be elected provisional president of the country, a post he held only for a few weeks. He was forced to resign and then spent the remainder of his life until 1925 fighting to get back that position of power and make a difference in terms of charting China's future course.
So his presidency had a very long foreground and was itself basically a thing of the moment. And yet you're writing about him in terms of leadership as new models and old. Give us a sense of what the term leadership might have meant to Sun Yat-sen himself.
Of course, for most Chinese and for many people who study China, traditional Chinese leadership is associated with the emperor, who was rarely seen by the average Chinese person and had a much closer relationship with his officials. And so leadership in China might mean head of family, head of clan, head of a merchant guild, or it might be the official who presided over a large county, or it might be the emperor who is so remote from people's lives. What Sun Yat-sen and leaders like him did was to make leadership much more of a face-to-face relationship, something much more intimate. And that was necessary because the idea of a republic as opposed to monarchy imagines that the people themselves play some fundamental close role in politics. Mm-hmm. And this was Sun Yat-sen's dream. He was as much an anti-monarchist as Tom Paine, let's say. Hmm. He believed that without that kind of revolution, China could never progress and join the first ranks of nations. And so he was dedicated, first of all, to getting rid of monarchy, and second of all, and this is the part I've been particularly interested in, trying to chart a course for the new republic as it emerges in 1912.
I noticed in your work that you say that one of his challenges, one of the difficulties, was the creation of Chinese leadership without necessarily grafting onto these old models, the new models that were available to him in the West. Can you talk about that for a moment?
One of the things he did, which is a bit like the Western model, is to engage in public speaking. Now, this was complicated because although some elections were held in China in the early 1910s, for the most part, people became powerful by leading armies or parties. But Sun Yat-sen, like a few other leaders of this period, would go around the country and give speeches in which he would engage people, try to make an argument that he felt would convince them, and was greeted in some cases by applause, in other cases by wan sui. This is the Chinese term. In Japanese, it's banzai. It means 10,000 years. Now, this means long life. It also is the salutation used for emperors. And what Sun Yat-sen was confronted with was a highly eclectic, a mixed political culture at this time, where people knew full well what a republic was, most of them, but they also had a lingering psychology of politics, which I think held a place for someone high above them who they hoped would provide some form of justice, some form of security. And so Sun Yat-sen, like many other leaders of this period, had to develop a hybrid form of leadership.
Now, rhetoric is, as you've been implying here and stating, David Strand, is an important part of leadership for Sun Yat-sen. Can you give our listeners a concrete sense of what this term meant to this man? We're talking now about picking words and the way you string sentences together and the way you present yourself in public. This was part of his, political persona. Are we on the right track there?
Yeah, in many ways, although Sun Yat-sen was a visionary and dreamed of a future China, he was pretty practical in addressing people. For example, he noted that one of the words that was most likely to gain a response from Chinese of this period was the term fa cai. It means to get rich. You can still hear this as part of a New Year's greeting where someone might wish that their friend or colleague becomes wealthy in the coming year. Mm-hmm. And Sun Yat-sen argued that a term like fa cai, or get rich, means more to Chinese than a term like freedom or democracy. And so when he tried to describe the plans he had for developing China, for developing what he called a people's livelihood, he said, this is going to enable you and the country to get rich. He used homely terms, concrete examples, to try to draw his audience into this large, somewhat crazy project he had of making China in a few years, perhaps decades, the equivalent of a Great Britain or United States or Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's tricky to sort of psychologize a subject such as yours, David Strand, but give our listeners a sense of what words like sincerity, emotion, as they figure in the rhetoric of Sun Yat-sen, as he shapes himself into a Chinese leader. For example, did he talk down to his audiences? It's commonplace in American politics to assume that politicians are, to be sort of cynical, you know, that they've got speech writers and that they're really not genuinely connecting with their audiences. Tell us about Sun Yat-sen in that regard.
Well, there are probably two levels to this. On an intellectual level, Sun Yat-sen imagined himself as a teacher. And he was, in that sense, perhaps, in terms of knowledge, an elitist. He felt that there were some people who knew from the beginning what had to be done, individuals like himself, others who could convey that message, and the rest, the majority of the population, had to be told what to do. And so his rhetoric included a kind of didactic element that we can read today as being instructive rather than a dialogue. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when he spoke, he presented the image of someone of great vitality and great emotion. And at that level, I think there was much more a sense of equality with his audience. That is, everyone wanted to save China. Save China or die was a common slogan of the period. And on that level, despite the fact that Sun might be older than his audience in many cases, Sun might be more experienced and, from his point of view, more knowledgeable, that everyone was a Chinese and everyone shared in the need to complete this project of making China wealthy, strong, and independent.
How did Sun Yat-sen, David Strand, use a large and a malleable term such as freedom?
This is where it's necessary to reconstruct the times that Sun Yat-sen lived in to understand why, in many ways, he was so hostile to the idea of freedom while believing himself to be a Democrat and a Republican. We normally think that freedom goes with democracy and Republican government. The freedom that Sun Yat-sen was interested in, and here I think he also shared a great deal with many of his fellow citizens, was freedom for China. And so he argued that Chinese, traditionally, under the imperial system, had long had freedom. That is, the government was so small and remote that most people in their communities could do what they want, a kind of anarchy. Others also noted that perhaps anarchy was a natural part of the Chinese condition, so that most people in China who hadn't had to commit themselves to do anything maybe beyond paying taxes now had to join armies and to make a larger civic commitment. Secondly, he was often at odds with liberals in China during this period. That is, there were people who believed sincerely in freedom and democracy and feminism in ways that were quite comparable to what their counterparts believed in Europe or America or South America. And in this sense, Sun Yat-sen had a double battle to fight. On the one hand, he argued that Chinese had too much freedom. They needed more discipline so that the country could fight against its foreign enemies and solve its problems. He also argued that democracy required people to sacrifice their freedom in order that the larger good be served. And so he's a complex figure. He advocates elections, referenda, even recall ballots, but he's quite insistent on the need for individuals in particular and communities to sacrifice their autonomy for the greater good. And you can see in that sense how Sun Yat-sen's decision in the early 1920s to ally with the communists and to support Leninism was a natural turn for him.
David Strand, how did Sun Yat-sen connect with the sort of old Chinese culture, the 19th century and before? Words like feudalism, warlords, you talked about this diffuse effect of the government. It was there, and yet it wasn't there in many senses. How does Sun Yat-sen figure in those equations as China moves from traditional political formations into the modern world?
Well, as I mentioned, Sun was born on the coast and drawn out into the Pacific, as many Chinese were during this period, to make a living and to see the world. And then in exile and upon his return to China in 1911, he came back to China armed with all kinds of knowledge, which made him an appealing figure for many. That is, he understood the West. He understood the terms of competition.
Would it also have made him suspect in the eyes of some of his constituents?
Exactly. Early on, because of his humble background, many educated Chinese thought that he culturally was too backward. By the time he returns to China, many Chinese who were concerned about preserving Chinese culture thought he was too Western. And so toward the end of his life, he actually comes to emphasize not only the machines and the westernization in a technical sense that he was so fond of discussing, he also tries to find a more secure anchorage in Chinese tradition. And here he separated from many of the intellectuals of his time by arguing, for example, that the family was an important institution to be preserved. Hometown associations, which Chinese kept when they left their village or province and journeyed somewhere else, that was important. Clan was important. And so as Sun emphasizes the importance of the future and machines and technology, he also tries to hang on to a more organic, community-oriented vision of China. And in that, he's somewhat special, because the choice for many Chinese was either westernization or an attempt to hang on to Chinese culture at all costs. And Sun provides a model of someone who was trying to balance.
Well, he sounds like a good politician. He wants to have it both ways. He wants to be eclectic and draw the strengths from both the past as he looks to the future. The word nationalism is, again, a large sort of term here in the vocabulary that you as a historian, David Strand, use in writing about Sun Yat-sen. Tell us about that.
When Sun first started to use the term nationalism, minzu in Chinese, it really meant race. This was a time in the late 19th century when the way people talked about nationalism was largely in racial terms. And many Chinese feared not only that their country had been taken over by another race, that is the Manchus, another ethnic group, but that in competition with other countries, the Chinese race, the Han people, were about to be overwhelmed. Now, one thing that Sun does, even before he ends his exile and returns to China, was to move away from a purely racial definition of nationalism to something that would include people who lived in China who didn't happen to be Han Chinese, that is, the Mongols, the Tibetans, Muslims, and others, including, finally, the Manchus. So Sun is often given credit for a more inclusive sense of what it means to be Chinese, and you can see because his concerns were largely political mobilization. He wanted everyone, Han Chinese and non-Han men and women, that he had a kind of leveling impulse that despite his elitism in politics, he wanted to include everyone. And so his nationalism included people who may, like the Tibetans, not want to be included in his vision. But nonetheless, that was a step toward a more complete notion of China as belonging to Chinese and not exclusively to people who were Han Chinese, the majority.
Now, you say that for Sun Yat-sen, the word nationalism has a direct correlation with the term race. The harsh way to respond to that might be, are we talking about racism? Are we talking here about a sort of purity and exclusivity? That's a paradox. I mean, here you're talking about not polarizing people, but being inclusive. Yet I have heard it said that the Chinese, again, to use the harshest characterization, can be very racist in their attitudes toward other peoples. Are we talking about inside the country as well as outside?
Among the political class, race initially was an imported idea. That is, Chinese learned to be racist, if you will, by comparing notes with Germans and Americans and the French and the British. There is in the Chinese tradition color consciousness, a sense of having a civilized center and a barbaric periphery. So there are plenty of resources within Chinese culture which can be used to construct feelings about other people, which suggest that you're better than they are. But in a political sense, the racialism of China at the turn of the century, I think, had more to do with global trends than with domestic trends. Mm-hmm. However, because once you decide that everyone within the boundaries of the former Qing dynasty is a Chinese, and when people resist that inclusion, like Tibetans or others, then you're going to have a problem. And there certainly has been in the 20th century history of China plenty of examples of racist action taken by the government and by Chinese. And Sun Yat-sen's significance perhaps might be, although I suppose in a patronizing way from the point of view of these minority groups, the notion that to be Chinese is a fact of citizenship. He was quite proud of China and its cultural traditions, and when he waxes eloquent about Chinese past, one does find a kind of racial consciousness. But for the 20th century, he wanted everyone to work together, and for that reason, he was quite keen to be inclusive rather than exclusive, in a qualitarian rather than developing some kind of racial or ethnic hierarchy.
Right. David Strand, you are a historian writing about leadership in China in the 20th century. We're talking about Sun Yat-sen. Is it possible quickly to talk about Sun's legacy when we speak of the Chinese leadership? Here we're looking back over a period of 70, 80 years. How do you figure out how that leadership is important and how it comes to us today?
Probably in the first instance, it has to do with rescuing the notion of leadership from the wreckage of the early republic. After 1912, the government in Beijing began borrowing from foreign governments, assassinating political rivals, bribing government officials, and doing everything seemingly it could to delegitimize the notion of a national republican government. And during this time, Sun Yat-sen retained his faith that China needed a very powerful government, and that a powerful government needed a prestigious and effective leader. And so I think his legacy in the first instance, to the point when he dies in 1925, is to reserve a space for someone who could see the future, represent the people, and as he himself claimed, think for the rest of the country. He was able to make an identification between himself and the country that many, though not all, people accepted. Mm. And so later when Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping do the same, that is, claim to represent the country, they are following along in a path that had been developed by Sun Yat-sen. He didn't live to have the kind of power that those later political leaders had, but he was able to project an image of someone who was at the center of things and still had some kind of intimate emotional connection to the average Chinese, either mm-hmm. in terms of interest, we'll build a strong country, or emotion, that is, we all care about saving China. Mm-hmm. And that kind of legacy, which shows up in his clothing, he developed a distinctive form of clothing, which was called the Sun Yat-sen suit, later known as the Mao suit. In terms of his image and where it hung, his image hung outside the Gate of Heavenly Peace in Beijing, and in a whole kind of legacy of the leader as icon, the leader as someone that you think of when you think of China. These are things that Sun Yat-sen worked on, not always successfully, but he set a kind of model or pattern for later political figures.
David, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. I'm going to put the crystal ball here in front of you for a moment. Give our listeners a sense of your take on where we are, that is to say, the United States of America and the People's Republic here in the on the verge of the 21st century. We see all this stuff in the papers about how we get hung up on the trade talks and the cultural exchanges and the political harmony. Because of human rights issues. Are we talking, for instance, here about two completely different mindsets that are just irrevocably separate from one another? Are the Chinese entitled to say to the Americans, get lost, we'll make these decisions on our own. If you want to trade with us, terrific, we'll do that. I'm asking you to just give us a general sense of where we are in the relationships between our two countries and some of the specifics that may or may not help us.
Well, one of the things that Sun Yat-sen said early on is that China's problems will include discussions and relationships among Chinese, but also with foreigners in the larger world, that he had a national consciousness, but also a global consciousness. And I think that Sun Yat-sen was willing to admit those foreign influences, but only because he also asserted a Chinese identity. And so one problem with the human rights debate between China and the United States is that it's quite possible for Chinese to read concerns about human rights as an attempt to impose these outside values on China. On the other hand, Chinese values as they've developed in the 20th century have typically been hybrids, where Chinese have looked at the rest of the world and values and institutions and have selected or tried to select those that they find appropriate. So mm-hmm. you can find advocates for human rights and freedom of a more liberal sort in China beginning at the turn of the century. So to say that human rights are not Chinese is not true. There are plenty of individual Chinese who have argue that position from early in the century to the present day. On the other hand, as I suggested earlier in terms of Sun's views of issues like freedom, that those who have looked at China as a large nation, a continental nation with gigantic problems, the notion that individual concerns should come before the collective, that there should be actions taken that might harm the larger interest of China to benefit individuals has often been interpreted as a form of selfishness. If one used Sun Yat-sen as a model, one would look for balance, a appreciation of human rights that would accept the unique features of the Chinese tradition, but also keep China open to the rest of the world. And probably that would be good advice for most countries. A second part of this problem is that when U.S. deals with China today, it won't find a strong leadership, that the arc of leadership that begins with Sun Yat-sen and moves through Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping, I think now is falling. So it's unlikely that China will find some one person to deal with or some one person who can sell the case to the Chinese people. And so any discussion of trade issues or human rights or any other common concern is bound to be complicated. And bound to include a lot of misunderstandings. So that I think at this stage where China is much more complex and more fragmented, and the United States, one might argue, has been that way for some time, that discussions of issues across cultures are likely to lead to misunderstandings, and a sense of balance is probably needed in dealing with something like that.
David, a quick footnote to our conversation. Give us a personal sense of your involvement with Chinese history and Chinese culture. You got a favorite place that you visit, a favorite Chinese meal? I don't want to trivialize our conversation, but I'm curious about this sort of thing. Talk to our listeners about that.
Well, I guess I would follow Sun Yat-sen in this regard. Maybe my favorite Chinese food is bean curd or tofu. Sun had pointed out early on that when he was beginning to try to make these connections between East and West, he noticed that European nutritionists were quite keen to find a meat substitute for vegetarian diets. And Sun said, well, of course, China for centuries has had bean curd. Done up as spicy bean curd or in other dishes is perhaps a favorite of mine, and it represents, I think, an aspect of Chinese culture that Sun Yat-sen himself found quite appealing, maybe a point of discussion in terms of what one can appreciate in a culture so old and so vast.
David Strand teaches at Dickinson College. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a study of Chinese President Sun Yat-sen in the early years of the 20th century. David Strand is the author of a book about Beijing in the 1920s and co-editor of a forthcoming collection of essays entitled Reconstructing 20th Century China. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this week's show. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Audio tapes are available for $10 post-paid. Write to us for a tape or with your comments. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 834. That's $10, program number 834. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week, in partnership with the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, Soundings presents conversations featuring West Virginia Governor Gaston Caperton and telecommunications policy expert Sally Johnstone. They'll be here to talk about recent developments in information technology, public policy, and American education. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a weekly cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.